Hi, guys. Welcome back to another episode of the BFG podcast. It's been probably a while since we've done a regular podcast episode. I've done some like just kind of goofy videos for myself and with Haven, but I'm back and I am not with Mike this time. I'm with
the better Mike.
New Mike. Mike 2000.
Yes.
But just to clarify, whenever Mike watches this, this is not like throwing shade at him or anything. This is not whatever we say.
I should have thought before I said that. Yeah, yeah, that's kind of whoops.
This isn't like we're replacing Mike. This is just Garrett and I. We spend a lot of time talking about movies, a little bit more in depth, I think.
Very in depth.
Yeah, because Mike and I tend to have kind of like our kind of like broad appeal movies that we both watch. You know, we talk about like the Marvel movies, video game movies, stuff like that, that we have like our overlapping interests. Whereas when Garrett and I talk, it's always about, it's like deep dives into like directors and filmographies and stuff that
get intense.
Yeah, it's less mainstream. And so I think this is going to be a little bit of a different kind of segment than we usually get with Mike. But it's also kind of not really prepared, because with Mike, what we would normally do is we would have a movie that we would go see, like we'd watch the new Avengers movie or something like that. And then we would like immediately, whether it be that afternoon or the next day, we'd come back and we'd talk about it. And this is not that either. This is just us kind of coming on and talking, and it might get more structured as it goes on. But it's kind of just you and I decided this would be a fun thing to do because...
Yeah, well, like, we talked about movies for hours a day for, like, 6 weeks straight. Mm-hmm. And kind of, like, once that ended, it was kind of like, oh, man.
Yeah.
That kind of sucks. I miss talking to Tyler every single day about movies.
Yeah.
No, and it's kind of, like...
It kind of became, like, the bright spot of my day.
Yeah, you know? Right?
Like, I get ready to come in, and this was... I don't want you to get the impression, like, if you're listening in or watching it, I don't want you to get the impression that this was something we would just do, you know, on our free time. Like, we would waste, like, an hour or two of our work days. Because
we'd be on break.
Yeah, Garrett would be there in the mornings, and I'd come in for the afternoons, and we'd sit there during our lunch hour together talking about movies. And so I think the other part of it that's going to be weird is we can't really eat food while we talk anymore.
We can in future episodes. We can.
Yeah, I suppose
it'll just
could.
Sound disgusting.
Yeah. We can turn it into a mukbang.
Oh, God.
But yeah, so this first one, we kind of just threw it together because I'm trying to get together more parts and make it a little bit more like a professional, like, studio style.
By next episode, it should be, like, really good looking. For for amateurs, yeah, pretty, like, come on.
Yeah, like, for two guys like us who are just kind of doing it for fun, and, you know, we probably shouldn't be spending
We're not
a
making
of
anything off this.
It.
Yeah, yeah, we're just... literally losing money for this.
But it's something that we're both passionate about, like, just the, not just, like, watching movies, but just the process that goes into them. And that's why I think this will be a little bit different and kind of a unique segment. Is because it's going to be less about, you know, oh, we saw the new video game movie and we're going to talk about it for a little bit, which is a lot of fun to do. But what you and I normally
get into, I'm sure we will do that occasionally too.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure we will. But it's also going to be a little bit more like analytical about the filmmaking process. And so it's just something that we decided to do, and we're putting like our time and money and effort into it with zero return right now, just because,
yeah,
why not?
Negative return, really. And it's kind of funny too, because we've known each other for years, and like neither of us kind of like we didn't really talk about movies the way that we did over the summer until like really recently.
Yeah,
so like this is kind of like still a little bit new to us too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we never got like this in depth. I don't think I've ever really gotten this in depth with anyone about movies.
Yeah, we go pretty deep with each other.
Yeah. Whoa, okay, all right.
We get real deep with each other.
Yeah. It's turning into something else.
But anyway, so we were kind of talking about it, and I was kind of preparing, like, I'm getting a couple pieces in that I'm hoping will make a kind of a mobile, like, semi-professional setup that we can use for, like, a couple different sets and make it look a little better so that...
It would be kind of really fun to, like, have a different location every once in a while.
Yeah.
But, like, a wacky one, kind of.
So, yeah, we're going to have... if you're watching, we're going to have some, like, a couple different, like, sets, I guess. And if you're listening, hopefully the audio quality will kind of bump up over time and stuff too. But it's we're waiting on those parts to come in, and we both decided that we didn't want to wait for those parts to come in.
No.
And so we were like, what if we just go ahead and do an episode and then watch it like transform in front of our eyes? Because
yeah,
first of all,
I think like cool. One of the big things is we thought it would be really funny.
Yeah. Like, I think it'll be cool. Like, if we actually stick with it and keep doing these episodes to watch it like kind of unfold as we go, I think it'll be kind of like an experience. But also, yeah, I think it'd be really funny if we get these parts in and it's like, this episode is really janky, and then immediately like the next episode looks like semi-professional.
We're both gonna have the same cameras and the same lenses and all that. Like, it's gonna, the picture quality is gonna be the same. The audio quality might be a bit different, because I think I don't know what kind of mic you're gonna get, but I'm sure it's still gonna be like good no matter what, like the audio side.
Well, and that's something I've delved into a little bit more just since I started the podcast. Like, the video equipment is more your end. You're the one that's really good with like camera equipment, and you know that side of it. And that's something that I'm hoping to learn from you during all of this too. But I think the other part of it is, I don't know how much experience you have like with the audio side of it.
I'm pretty raw with audio.
It's not like I've done a lot with audio, but I know my way around it well enough that I've set up a bunch of filters to kind of make me sound really good. But that's kind of where things get a little bit tricky, because everybody has a unique voice profile. And so I've got like my my profile set up so that I think I sound pretty good whenever I'm recording, but it sounds good for my voice. So like for you or for Mike, it might not pick up or sound as good on this same profile, but I'm hoping it will. I'm hoping that it's general enough that if you're here and we're recording together instead of through video chat next time, or just over time, that it'll still sound good. But it's going to be like a learning and growing process as we go. So I think it'll be like fun for us, just from like the goofy perspective of like watching it change every week. But I think it'll also be kind of like a fun learning experience, not just about like movies and stuff, but also like just the process of doing this.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And that is another thing. We are planning on like actually getting together and doing these at like the same desk instead of just being over video chat. That's like the next step. Hopefully the next one will be that. Depends on how it works. Yeah. We don't know how it's going to work out. Again, we're two dudes that like are usually pretty busy. So like, you know, like maybe it'll work out. It'll be fine. We'll figure it out. Another thing, like the whole movie chat thing, kind of great. Because you can, like, seeing other people's perspectives on these kinds of things, like, you might have one interpretation of a movie, like the movie Mother, we are both very different on, and like, very much so.
We can talk about that more in depth, but I think we have some, like, similar feelings about it, but, yeah, it's...
Yeah.
I think...
So, like... We'll have
we'll spend more time on that one. We'll have to have like either an episode just dedicated to Mother or just dedicated to like Aronofsky.
That's kind of like what that. I was hoping for. I have an entire script for a video. If you're wondering why I have a mustache, it's because I'm planning a video for Darren Aronofsky's filmography, and I have the entire script written out for every single movie and all that. So,
but yeah, so it's kind of a spur of the moment thing, because we had discussed, you know, actually having a plan and knowing what we were going in, whether it be some sort of ranking or list or dissection of a filmography or something. And then, like, what, yesterday or 2 days ago, we were like, we just kind of want to get started.
Yesterday. Yeah, that
and
was.
And so, so we're just using the equipment we've got in the spaces we've got.
Yeah.
There's absolutely zero professional
I'm literally balancing my camera tripod and external monitor on my bed as we speak. Like, it's not, it's very, I have a lamp behind me lighting the entire background. It's not some like big thing. And like, you know, we're working with what we got. And
yeah,
by next episode, it'll be much better. I'm planning on getting some lights, I think, that we can use. I think you're getting lights too, aren't you?
I'm getting an LED light that we can use that we're going to mount to like the recording setup. But I mean, even now I've got pretty solid lighting here in the garage and I've got a ring light like in front of me already too. So lighting, I don't necessarily have an issue with, but I'm getting another one that's going to be mounted to like the recording setup, to kind of give it like a focal point.
My girlfriend kind of went over the lighting in my shot and like the different lenses. She was helping me like pick out which lens I wanted to use and like what angle to go with and all that. So we landed on the one I got now, which is a 25 millimeter with a ND filter on it, just to kind of like blur out the background a little bit more. And I'm liking the way it looks, but I look really red right now. If you could see like on there, I'm completely red, but it really brings out the mustache. So, you know, not all bad.
So if that's what you're going for, you're just all mustache right now.
Basically. I grew out the mustache just for the Aronofsky video, because of on his IMDb page, it's just a picture of him. And, I don't know if you've ever heard Aronofsky speak. He's totally just a dude. He's such a fun dude from like Brooklyn. When people talk about him being like pretentious, he's literally just like some fun guy. He's just like, yeah, I just felt like making this movie. And like, and he has like kind of a Kermit the Frog voice. And in his picture, he's going like with his mustache. And it looks so great. And I love it.
All right. So now that we've already gotten off on a couple tangents, but so for today or for this evening, oh my gosh, it's already 11. Okay. But point being, whenever I was trying to figure out what to do, I remembered like 3 days ago or something, there was a post that had been floating around on like my different social media. So you might've seen it too. Cause I had seen it on Facebook and I saw it on Instagram. And it had just like popped up like 3 or 4 times. So I saved it just as something to like pick up later and think about later. And then whenever we were talking about doing this tonight, I was like, oh, okay, that'll be the perfect excuse to bring this back out. And I kind of have conflicting feelings about it because it's very much like a modern day, like social media post, which kind of irks me a little bit because I feel like a lot of times I kind of feel like I'm above that because it's covered in like hashtags and it's from a page called like Cinema Heads and stuff like that. And I'm like, it feels really cringy, you know, but at the same time, you know, it's like whenever you were like 10 years old and you made your first social media site and they would post those little surveys about like, you know, what was the name of your first pet? What was the name of the street you grew up on? What was your favorite color in third grade? You know, like those kind of things. And it's like, you know, when you were 10 years old, you were like, oh, this is fun. And then you look back at it in your 20s and you're like, why was I that kid? And I feel like it's kind of the same thing. Like I look at these posts sometimes and I'm like, like I kind of want to delve into that, but I don't want to be associated with it at all at the same time. But it's basically just a series of questions where they ask about like your favorites and least favorites within like cinema. And so I just kind of like saved it for later. And then I was like, oh, this would be an easy thing to talk about because it gives you kind of like an easy list of just kind of movie topics. And so I was thinking we could bust that out. And, you know, if we get all the way through it, that's fine. Or if we just get like the first like 5 or 10, because it's us, we can do that too. And you know, so I could see us like kind of blazing through it, or I could see us getting through like the first 2 questions and that taking like 3 hours.
Yeah, either option is possible. Yeah.
Yeah. So I figured I've got that here if you wanted to.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that sounds awesome.
So number one, we'll start off easy. It's just, what is your favorite movie?
Okay. Thank you. So my favorite movie, and you know this quite well, because after I saw it, I could not stop talking about it. And to an extent, I still can't stop talking about it, is Black Swan, which, again, Darren Aronofsky coming up. He's been on the mind a lot recently from, you know, everything that's being, like, you know, all the stuff that I'm doing about him. But so it's funny that you bring it up, because earlier today I was going through different streaming services trying to look for something to watch just to entertain myself waiting for the podcast to start. And I go on Hulu, and over the past few, like, months, every time I want to watch Black Swan, but I want to watch it on my computer or something, instead of, like, having to, like, put the Blu-ray into my, like, Xbox or PlayStation, I would rent it on Amazon, which I don't mind at all. Like, I want, you know, money to go to the filmmaker. But then I go on Hulu, and I see that it's just free on Hulu. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
But, so, like, you've been paying for it?
Yeah, like, over and over? Dude, I bought it, like, 4 times. It's like, it's only like $4, but it adds up, you know. And I'm a college kid, so, you know, it's a little rough. But
and at that point, you could have just, like, bought the Blu-ray or something.
I have the Blu-ray. Too. It's right here.
Why are you still renting it?
Because, like, there would be times I want to, like, we have a movie night on my friend's Discord channel, and I want to stream Black Swan and show people it. And so, like, I just keep streaming Black Swan, and I could have just done it on Hulu. But
hey, it shows dedication.
Yeah, but I really had to, like, choke back the urge to watch it again today, because I knew that, like, they probably wouldn't have time to see the whole thing, and I'd want to finish the whole thing. But, like, I non-ironically think it is a perfect film. I don't think it's the best film ever. Not that I don't think, it's that I can't make an argument for it, because I think that that's such a, like, such a stupid argument to have, is, like, what's the best film ever made? There's so many different things you can go over for that. But in my mind, this is a perfect film that I can watch any time of any day and not be upset. I can leave, like, a 5-year-old's birthday party, or I can leave a funeral and go watch Black Swan and be completely, like, feel the exact same emotions every single time. Mm. Everything about this is all I want in a movie, and I had no idea this is what I wanted until I saw it.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and I feel like, I mean, there's obviously people that aren't going to enjoy it, but I think one of the things that I really appreciate about Black Swan is that it's kind of like artsy and abstract, but it also is at the same time accessible and still has that mainstream appeal.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a little bit, like, artsy and abstract without, like, alienating an audience either.
Exactly.
And so I feel like it's a really good movie at capturing a really wide range of people, which is a hard thing to do a lot of times.
Oh, yeah.
Without just going, like, mindless summer blockbuster.
Yeah, and that's a testament to Aronofsky's vision, I guess. In a lot of interviews, he would say that, like, everyone kept shutting down the movie or, like, turning it down whenever they'd go to people to try and find financing for it. He would go to these studios, and he'd be like, hey, I have this ballet movie about a dancer, and it's kind of a horror movie. And they'd be like, oh, no, sorry, ballet people don't like horror, and horror people don't like ballet. And then until he finally got financing and put the movie out, and it cracked, like, $300 million in the box office to this day on a $13 million budget, is, like, you know, insane. It shows, like, how this movie has so many different accessible lanes for people to go into that, like, it could just kind of transcend any kind of, you know, social barriers you would assume it would have. And, like, it still has the kind of avant-garde artistic sign to it. Like, the opening shot, the opening scene, where Natalie Portman is dancing in the completely pitch black room with, like, the great, that beautiful kind of reflection on the floor. And then, you know, Rothbart, the black swan demon, comes out of nowhere and starts dancing with her, and the music swells, and then it just goes away. Like, it's just, it's insane. yet they still have those kind of common horror tropes, like all the mirror shots and everything. They have those great musical stings that will come up throughout, like when Natalie Portman sees her mother sleeping in a bed next, or in a chair next to her bed. Anytime, like, you know, like you'll just get those classic stings that you would expect from like a 70s or 80s horror film, but done up in like kind of a fantastical ballet world kind of way, where the music is like, you know, still somehow beautiful, even though it's supposed to make you feel terrified.
Yeah.
And it's really effective.
Yeah, no, it uses those musical motifs better than I feel like a lot of horror movies especially are good at. Like, you kind of have, you know, in any genre, you have like your better examples of like them using music to either evoke certain emotions or to make you familiar with certain characters and stuff like that. And that calls back to, you know, like the basics of music as an art form. You know, you learn normally in elementary school, you learn about Peter and the Wolf, and you watch the video where it's like each character has their own musical sting that plays whenever they're on screen and shows them doing their thing and stuff like that. And you're kind of trained from a young age to recognize those patterns. But I feel like horror is an area where normally that part of filmmaking lacks. And the fact that it's executed so well in a film that appeals to a lot of like horror genre enthusiasts,
but also still really like the artistic people as well.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. I had no interest really in ballet. My girlfriend danced for 16 years and she did point for like that almost 2 decades. And, you know, she's talked about it quite a bit and we've discussed it. She's shown me ballets before and I was like, these are really, like, really interesting and I enjoy watching them, which surprised me. And then Black Swan kind of came up, like, happened to come up around, like, the perfect time when, like, well, kind of, like, came into view for me to watch. Not, like, you know, came out, came into view for me to, like, an opportunity for me to see it. At this perfect time where I was like already kind of like getting an interest in ballet, and then I see it and I'm like, yo, what's happening? And
yeah,
it really just like latched itself onto me really quickly. And I think a lot of that is also has to do with Natalie Portman and her performance in it. I've always liked Natalie Portman. I think everyone likes Natalie Portman. Like, there's not one person that'll talk bad about Natalie Portman, but, like, she...
I can find someone.
You... Who?
I bet I could get Haven, too.
Okay, come on. That's not fair.
because Haven hates everybody.
Okay, good point. But, yeah, I think that she sells that performance perfectly. It is incredible. The amount of, like, different emotions and the, kind of, like, the highs and the lows that she gets to throughout the performance. The fact that she's able to keep that very high-pitched soprano throughout, like that kind of like young girl innocent talk, really adds to like the feeling, the visceral feeling of her being taken advantage of by all these different people throughout like the film. And that kind of adds on to like how much you feel for the character. So like it, you could, so her doing all that shows that it's not all like the writing, which the writing is still fantastic, but it shows that it's not all the writing that leads to a good character. A lot of it is like the own, like the actor's own kind of decisions and like how they want to portray that character and everything. And this, all that stuff was all her idea, and she really sold it and did it amazing. Like, it's like, I find it hard to put into words how much I love this movie. I've kind of fallen out of listening to normal music, and I tend to only listen to the Black Swan soundtrack for like the past few months. Like, if I'm not gonna like listen to a podcast or watch a video or something, that's what's gonna be playing. And
okay,
like I find it interesting because I've never been someone to just kind of like put on classical music, classical sounding music with no lyrics or anything like that. but this gets me into such like a weird emotional state that I can't help but go back to it. And that, like, you know, I'm going to wrap this up soon, but I want to talk about like a couple specific moments. One being, the moment where Natalie Portman fully becomes the Black Swan. You get that beautiful music cue. You hear the fluttering of like feathers in the background. The sound design, amazing, really like gets you in there. You hear like the prickling of the feathers going up her arms and such. And you like, she's breathing heavily. And then finally she notices herself, like all the feathers coming out. And you know that it's like her going legitimately crazy. But that insanity is bringing her to perfection and what she actually wants. And then the music kicks in even more and you get those trumpets and it goes off and she does the dance. I bumped my mic. Oh, whoops. And she does the dance and it is like, oh my God. And the way the camera follows her, the way the lighting is done, where it's like, it looks so gritty, but still like shows the beauty behind it. All the subtle details, like the shadows in the background being like having wings like a swan, but like she clearly doesn't have wings. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And then the final scene, the very final dance where she goes up the products, like that produced, stage prop. And, she, like you hear the music swell again as we get that far zoom out and you see the blood kind of growing in her stomach. In that torso area, and then she jumps down, and right when she jumps down, that's when the music changes to like a lighter fluttering kind of sound, and it's a slow-mo shot as she falls to the mattress, and and you see like kind of like the nirvana come over her face. Like, she knows she's achieved perfection. She's literally dying, but she's happy because she's achieved perfection. And then it fades to white. Oh my God, what? Like, how do you...
I hadn't thought about it until you were describing it like that. There's kind of a similar filmmaking, I guess, style and a filmmaking technique that they used in Whiplash.
Yeah, that movie gets compared a lot to Black Swan.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about it until you were describing it. And then I was like, that's a lot like Whiplash.
Yeah.
Which is also a really good movie, but kind of off topic, too.
Like... we can talk about Whiplash any day. I still love Whiplash. But yeah, this movie is kind of, for me, I know it wouldn't be the first one, but for me, it's kind of the baseline of any movie that's talking about like chasing perfection and trying to achieve that perfection. This is like, you know, this is that movie that really cements that kind of like zeitgeist for it.
All right. So that was the sidebar, but like, did you have more?
No, that's it. I could go on for days, but like, that's, you know.
So I think similarly, as far as like musical scores and just talking about how like music affects the films, my favorite movie would probably be a toss up between either Shaun of the Dead or Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Which I think if you hadn't guessed, you know, it's pretty indicative of like Edgar Wright is one of my favorite directors. And I think depending on the day you ask me, I might say that like Alien is up there. I might consider that like one of my favorite movies
really,
as well.
Really, Alien?
Yeah, the first Alien. But I think if you're asking me what my absolute favorite film is, it'd probably be Shaun of the Dead. I think even at this point, I can't say that anything has beat Shaun of the Dead for me. Which, you know, there's as he went along in his filmography, he got even more.
Would you say he's Edgar Wright? I'm sure like
yeah, Edgar Wright,
know, but you know,
yeah, Edgar Wright directed Shaun of the Dead, and I think as the years went on, he got even more absorbed with this idea of the marriage of music and film making like a perfect like blend. And so you see it more in movies like Scott Pilgrim versus the World and Baby Driver and stuff like that. But in Shaun of the Dead, you still have those like really good musical moments. whether it be through reference, whenever they're like looking through the records, trying to decide which ones they can waste on like killing zombies, or the homage to Queen, whenever they're like beating the zombie in the Winchester pub and stuff like that. You know, there are all these like really good musical moments. But I think that's kind of, for me, that movie where I can't really think of one moment that they could cut that would still make such a like a cohesive, like complete film. I think all of the story beats and the music and the gags all work together so well. Like, it's such a tight package that I think if you removed it, it would be to its detriment. But if you added anything, it would also be to its detriment.
Yeah, they can get that like perfect middle ground.
Yeah, it's so well done. And it's like, it's such a perfect blend that I don't know if that could have been edited or created any better.
It's really surprising too for a first feature.
Like, you know, they had had some experience working in TV, but yeah, to come out of the gate like that, it's like, but I mean, you could say the same thing, I guess, about M. Night Shyamalan. He made The Sixth Sense.
Come on, don't compare
and then...
M. Night to Edgar Wright. Come on.
Well, yeah, like, I'm not comparing them in, like, their filmmaking styles, but yeah. I'm just saying, you know, they come out the gate with these, like, strong performances, and it's hard to, you know, you're only one-upping yourself from there.
Yeah,
which
but
is
it
a
does
hard
feel
do
like
sometimes.
Edgar Wright does one-up himself almost every time.
Yeah, he keeps refining his own filmmaking.
Yeah, even though he did set the bar so high for himself with Shaun of the Dead, and when a movie doesn't fully achieve that, like, kind of greatness that Shaun did, like with, let's say, like, At World's End, it's still mm-hmm. a great movie that you can enjoy no matter what. And you can yeah. look past that anytime. Like you could be like, yeah, yeah, sure, it's not as great as Shaun of the Dead, but it's still like a really fun movie no matter what.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Because when you watch M. Night Shyamalan, he had a really good movie, and from there it was just downhill.
When I do see some of his like good stuff, I'm not impressed by it really. Like,
it's all about the gimmick. He had The Sixth Sense, and he became known as the guy with all the twist endings. And so now there's like pressure to have twist endings, and you can't keep pulling those off without either being derivative of other movies or derivative of yourself. And so I think where Edgar Wright's kind of filmmaking can be refined and improved upon, and so he keeps making, you know, these better and better films as he learns new techniques and refines his own style.
He also borrows a lot, which is like really fun to see. That's how you know that someone's like a student of the craft, like Edgar Wright or like Wes Anderson, for example. They both borrow a lot, but like put their own twist on it in a new fun way that makes it like better for modern audiences, because usually they'll take it from like an older film or like a foreign film, and it, like they make it so much their own still that like it's so refreshing.
I love, just beyond like his movies, I really like listening to Edgar Wright just talk about movies, or like watching his social media posts and things like that, because you can tell he has such a love for cinema. Like, he talks about movies the way you and I talk about movies, you know? Like, he's just so fascinated by the entire process and all of these films that, you know, most people haven't even heard of. Like, you can tell he just loves what he does.
And that's, like, very, I wouldn't say rare when it comes to directors. If you're going to be, like, a big film director, you kind of have to love, like, everything about what you do. But yeah, it's not very often that you really get those, like, great interviews and sound bites of directors that, like, just want to talk about movies to other people. Like, you'll get them with, like, say, Martin Scorsese, someone who's clearly been passionate about movies his entire life. You'll get it with Darren Aronofsky, because he's got a lot of interviews like that. You get it with Edgar Wright. But, like, you know, how often do you get, like, a George Lucas interview where he's not just, like, blowing it up his own ass the entire time, talking about how great Star Wars is?
Well, I mean, you got... you gotta give the guy what he's got, you know? After Star Wars, he never really...
He didn't give himself another chance to do anything else. All he wanted to do was Star Wars, because he knew it would make him a ton of money. and it did. So like, granted, the guy's a billionaire.
He did
now,
exactly what he wanted to do. He made all of those Star Wars movies and then sold it off, and he can just live forever off of his Star
Skywalker
Wars money.
Ranch.
No, like, you don't have to respect him as like a filmmaker.
No,
but you
gotta
respect
the hustle.
Like,
yeah.
No, he did exactly what he meant to do.
The guy has his own way of doing it, and you know, God, if he didn't do it right.
Unfortunately, we're kind of seeing what George Lucas could have done with Peter Jackson, because he came out the gate, you know, he had like his obscure like 80s British movies and stuff, or 90s,
He's
I guess.
He's from New Zealand.
New Zealand.
You uncultured asshole. How do you not know that? They have like an entire, that's the, half of New Zealand's economy is based off of Peter Jackson.
But you know, like, he's got like his couple like older, more obscure like horror movies,
like Bad
and stuff.
Taste and all that.
Yeah, Bad Taste.
But
and,
it's weird because he would follow that up, like sometimes he'd follow it up with like a romantic comedy, which is like really interesting to see.
But then he did The Lord of the Rings, and it was just, you know, it blew everybody's minds.
The last thing you would expect from him.
Yeah. And then he started doing a little bit more, you know, just kind of like the accessible stuff. You know, he started going into like King Kong and stuff like that, and people were like, you know, oh, this is still like fine filmmaking, but it's not really the same caliber. And then he did the Hobbit movies, and everybody was like, why is he still doing this? And now he's still like trying to make movies, and it's just not really working for him. You
I
know,
think documentaries and I like, are working for him though. I think that's where he's sort of gotten back into his stride. Yeah, They Shall Not Grow Old was a really like inventive, good documentary. About World War I, I think he did it very tastefully and did a really good job with it, like handling more of a serious matter but without like, you know, all the giant special effects and everything.
Yeah,
and I think that's kind of where he has to go in at this point. I know that he's having a new documentary release soon, and I'm hoping that'll also like, you know, continue the trend of him going back upward but in a different field.
But
you were saying with like narrative features, he kind of fell off his game really quick.
And that's, I feel like that was, you know, there was a lot of potential for George Lucas to do the same thing. And he was just like, nope, I'm just going to make some Star Wars movies and live off
He's
that
like,
forever.
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Jabba the
Which
Hutt.
Is great. Yeah. he's his own,
he's
like,
got a monkey psychic.
He's just his own favorite little fanboy.
He's sitting on like his bed with like crayons and like lined paper and his feet up, kicking in the background, just drawing Jar Jar Binks. Like, he's gonna be in my new movie.
He's got like the action figures he's playing with on the floor. Pew pew pew, lightsabers.
No. The other time they interview him, he's just like, I was in movies.
Okay. But so
we went on a tangent there.
We've made it through one question.
That's pretty good for us.
Yeah. No, I mean, considering we are what, almost 50 minutes into our recording now. The fact that we made it through an entire question and we're ready to move into a second one.
We can cut around it.
I feel like there's an implication that it's supposed to be TV. But the second question is a little bit vague. It just says favorite series. So I guess I'll let you keep that to your interpretation. Like I said, I think there's an implication that it's like your favorite TV series. But if you want to do like a mini series or a movie series or something like a franchise, I'll let you have that, because I know that you tend to stick more toward like the film end of it.
Yeah, but I do have a couple of favorite series that I'd love to talk about.
Okay.
And I would like to keep it between, like, I want to keep it in, like, miniseries and then TV series. But for me, at least, you can do, like, whatever you want. For TV series, I absolutely love a Canadian Viceland show that aired for a couple seasons called Nirvana, the Band, the Show. It is one of the wackiest kind of surreal comedies I've ever seen, but I have so much fun with it. So a little backstory on it. So this is Matt Johnson. Matt Johnson makes a movie in 2013 called The Dirties. Goes to Sundance. Okay. It does great.
Can I pause you for just a second? Yes. I want to point out to everybody that you're exposing yourself on camera.
My angle's way different. Yeah, you can see like my collarbone and up basically. Yeah. I'm like nips full out right now.
I saw it slipping and I was like, oh, we're gonna be that kind of podcast.
I mean, I could just take it off.
Who cares? They're only listening.
It's up to your imagination. I promise you, I'm totally ripped. Ears. Yeah.
All right, but anyway,
yeah,
surreal Canadian shows.
Yeah, so Matt Johnson makes a movie called The Dirties. It's about a school shooting, and it's done for like $10,000, I think. It goes to Sundance, and it does great. Kevin Smith buys it. I don't like Kevin Smith, but he was dead on with buying this movie, and it's a fantastic film. I think like we should talk about Matt Johnson, his style and stuff like that. He's made a couple movies, but he has a very unique style. I think you would enjoy it.
All right.
And then off the back of that, he's able, and because of a web series that he had developed before, which is also called Nirvana, the Band, the Show, with his friend Jay, which they were just friends, and they were like, hey, you want to make a web series? And so they did. And they were like, off of the back of The Dirties, they were able to pitch the web series as an actual show to Viceland. And Viceland's like, okay, you're going to have to greenlight it with your producer, though. And their producer was Spike Jonze, director of Her and, like, being John Malkovich and Adaptation. And
you keep throwing out these names that I just don't expect.
I know, right? And so Spike Jonze, luckily, is a man of art and culture. So when he sees this stupid, like, completely ridiculous pilot episode about them making a giant banner, but one of their dicks accidentally slips out in the photography of the banner, and then they like put it on top of a building and everyone sees his dick, and then it catches on fire. When he sees that, he's like, that's the show I want to produce, and he puts it out there and greenlights it.
That's a TV show?
That is a TV show. The rules in Canada are very different from the rules in the United States when it comes to like what can be shown. They curse, right? Like, they say everything.
Like, I understand that, but I think what's weird to me is the fact that you can take that kind of concept and extend it into a TV show. I feel like if you told me that was a movie, I'd be like, you know, okay. But, like,
that's only the pilot's, like, plot. The actual storyline for the entire show is there are these two guys, played by Matt Johnson and his friend Jay, and they have a band called Nirvana the Band. It's literally called Nirvana the Band, and they're so dense and so stuck in, like, movie culture from, like, you know, the past that that they don't know that there's already a band called Nirvana. And so, like, they think they have this completely original band name and all that, and it's super cool. But, you know, clearly they're not. That's just, like, a show portraying how dumb they are. And you never actually see them writing any music in the show. It's always, every single plot is all based around them trying to get, like, to have a show at this one nightclub in Toronto that they think will break them into the big times, and they'll become, like, super famous. It's called the Rivoli. And every episode, they're just trying to think of these crazy antics that will get them on into the Rivoli, and it never works. There's so many, like, whenever you think of someone thinking of a cartoonish, dumb, wacky bit, they do it, but in real life. And like in one episode, to try and get into the Rivoli, they sneak into a hospital and they kidnap a Make-A-Wish Foundation kid and take him on like a day of fun so that they can convince him to let them use his Make-A-Wish wish, and so they could wish for them to play a show at the Rivoli. That's like the whole thing. But the kid has a heart attack because they take him, he's clearly in the hospital for a reason, and they take him to like an amusement park, and he has a heart attack, and they have to bring him back to the hospital, leave him on like the steps, and then run away. And all of this is shot where, like, there are people that are actors that are, like, you know, taking part in the film, but the people around them in everyday life have no idea that they're being filmed. So, like, it's kind of like an Eric Andre sketch, but the entire show is this. And if something happens throughout the show, like a, including...
like a Sacha Baron Cohen movie?
Yeah, exactly. And if something happens kind of like with a Sacha Baron Cohen movie during the filming with, like, one of the random people on the streets that, like, interacts with them, then they will change the entire plot of the episode around what this one person said. Like, it is completely ridiculous. It makes no sense. But somehow it's so entertaining and fun. And it only ran for 2 seasons because Viceland got shut down. And there's a 3rd season that's already filmed and made, but I doubt it's going to be released anytime. It, like, stopped airing in 2018, I think. But the show is incredible, and I recommend it for anyone. And I have one other show that I would, that I really enjoy. It's called Nathan For You. Also kind of...
You were telling me about that.
Yeah. Very funny, very...
Same vein of, like...
Just for the most really part, yeah. Just people
broad,
messing
surreal
with...
humor. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's done in such a funny, smarter kind of, like, you know, just a different spin on it that, you know, it's very, very entertaining, and I recommended that one to everyone, too. So, what would you think?
I think I'm going to go a little bit more traditional, I guess. I think mostly just based on nostalgia, because, you know, it was one of those shows that I grew up with, was Boy Meets World.
Oh!
Boy Meets World was just that show that I had, you know, growing up. And I feel like it kind of grew with me, but I like that as it went on, it also just got more just broad and dumb.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the beginning, it was very much like that show about the kids' misadventures and him growing up in school and, you know, dating the girl and falling in love and all that. And, you know, they kept that aspect, but by the end, there was just this vein of, like, really strange, goofy humor that I feel like you don't see a whole lot within that kind of standard, like, sitcom format.
Yeah.
That just really appealed to me. Like, how familiar are you with Boy Meets World?
I've seen a few episodes when I was growing up, but never really, you know, got super into it.
So, like, in the first 4 seasons, Corey has his older brother, Eric, and he plays the pretty standard older brother shtick, you know, where he's, like, a little bit jerky to Corey, but, you know, he still has a heart of gold and loves him and takes care of him and stuff, and he has his own girlfriends, and he's like, yeah, and he's like, you know, hey, leave me alone, I'm with my girlfriend, I'm gonna pretend I don't know you at school, and so on and so forth, you know, the normal older brother thing. You see it in every sitcom ever. And then about 4 seasons in, they have this just, like, 180, where they give him, like, 3 or 4 dramatic episodes where he graduates high school and realizes that his scores are really bad and he can't make it into college. And they make it, like, those really serious, like, dramatic episodes about what he's going to do with his life and trying to rededicate himself and take his, like, GED so that he can get into college and all this stuff. And then after that, they completely give up. And for the entire rest of the run, from seasons 4 through 8, he's just dumb, like, dumb as a rock. But he's, like, also, like, weirdly, like, a savant. And so he'll, like, sit around just saying these really inane things and just acting like an idiot, but then he'll start spouting, like, platitudes and say, like, really smart things, and everybody just is like, who are you? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And so then in, like, I think it's in, like, season 6 or 7, he just leaves for a while and you just don't see him and you don't know what's going on. He shows back up wearing, like, robes, and he's got, like, a long scraggly beard and stuff. And he's changed his name to Plays with Squirrels. And it turns out he's been, like, living in the woods, like, and he's become, like, this sage hermit that lives in the woods and communes with the animals. And he starts telling people, like, how to live their lives and how to become better people because he's gotten so much smarter out in the woods with the animals and stuff. And it's this kind of like broad, dumb humor that just comes out of nowhere. And I just loved it, you know, like to have it go from like this show about a boy growing up and having, you know, these like moral lessons and relationship drama and all this to, by the end, they still had that, but the primary aspect of the show was this kind of just like really dumb humor mixed in with the relationship drama to break it up, like really appealed to me because it wasn't just another Friends or another like Will and Grace or another How I Met Your Mother or whatever show you want to compare it to. Mm-hmm. By the end, it got to be like Friends, but with the marriage of that kind of dumb, surreal humor. And yeah, it worked really well for me.
Something very unique for like a show of that, you know, build.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's I think that's my main recommendation.
Really not at all what I expected.
Yeah. No, growing up, that was what I watched.
And even to this day, it has like the same sting to it that you're always just going to enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's kind of great.
I'll go back and rewatch it like every few years, and I'll still like shed a tear at the end.
Oh,
during the final episode.
That's adorable.
Thanks. Okay, so they have the most underrated and the most overrated listed as like two separate questions. So I'm just gonna kind of
I'm gonna really
condense
good.
Those, and I'm just gonna ask you, what do you think is like the movie that doesn't get enough praise, and what's the movie that you think is just way too hyped?
That is really good. Oh man, this might take me a second.
So I can tell you what I think is one of the most overrated, at least for me, one that I never really understood the massive appeal for.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you it's one that we've talked about today.
Okay, yeah.
Star Wars.
The original?
I would say...
Or in general?
Well, I mean, yeah, in general, but also, like, if I was going to be specific, I would say the original and the... So episodes, like, 4 and 6. I feel like episode 5 is pretty solid. Still overrated, but not, like, overrated to the point that I'm like, it deserves to hit the top of that list.
But I think, when people cite that as their favorite Star Wars, I can understand why, but it's, I can't say I agree.
But I think episodes 4 and 6 are pretty just as much as episodes 4 and 6 of Star Wars have saturated the market, just considering the way Star Wars is regarded in our society now. I don't think it deserves all that.
No, I don't think so. Especially like you were saying, like thinking about today, how it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely like adds a new layer of context to it. Yeah, no, I'd have to agree. Is there like any, is that like your only reason why? Is there like any personal disinterest you have in it?
I mean, yeah, I can enjoy them for what they are, mm-hmm. but I think a part of it is my family. So every year they've made it like an annual thing where on New Year's Eve, they'll watch all the Star Wars movies, which was fine when there were 3 of them. And then it was more of a commitment, but it was still fine when there were 6 of them. And now there's like every year they do the movie marathon, but they also every year start fighting, or not fighting, but arguing about a week beforehand about which movies to include, because they're like, there's just not enough time to watch all of the Star Wars movies anymore before midnight to hit like the new year. So then it's like there's kind of like this idea of like, well, which ones do we squeeze in? And I feel like it's just a lot.
It is, you know, a especially lot when it's you're too watching much media annually.
Yeah, like it's a lot for a day, but I feel like it's also just a lot of repetition of Star Wars. I think I just kind of eventually burned out. Like I'll rewatch the Star Wars movies every 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, that seems fine.
I don't when I'm watching them every year, I'm like, I don't feel like I need to see this again yet.
And there's so much in the media that you're always going to remember, like, how they go down and what happens in them.
Yeah. So it's not even necessarily that I watch them and I'm like, ah, these suck. But I kind of watch them and I feel like they're overhyped because I kind of got just a general disinterest a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. I think I've kind of gotten one. One would definitely for me have to be Joker. I think Joker was massively overrated. When I first watched it, I enjoyed it like quite a bit compared to like the other superhero films that would be out there. And then once I watched it again, it fell off so hard. And anytime I've tried to rewatch it, it's just, you know, no, it's not been good. Like, well, not, I wouldn't say not been good. It's been so average or mediocre. And it feels like the times that it does try to do artistic things, it's trying way too hard.
That's one of those things that it's hard for me because I'm also not the kind of person that just goes back and rewatches movies a lot in general, even with my favorite movies. And so, like, because I kind of did the same thing. I remember really enjoying Joker the first time I saw it in theaters. But at the same time, I can't remember watching it again since it was in theaters.
Yeah, it's not, so you don't really get an urge to rewatch it.
Yeah, I don't know if I could. That's another one. I hadn't even thought about that. Was The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games
were so hyped up. And they've kind of dropped off really fast, too. You don't really hear much hype for them anymore. But when those were coming out and those were in theaters, that was like a big deal. And that was a moment in cinema.
I would go every year to see the new one.
Yeah. And I was like really hyped for the first one. And then I saw the first one. And I remember enjoying the first one. But I also kind of immediately forgot about it and just didn't care either. And I don't know why. I can't even like describe why I felt that. But I saw it and I was like, oh, that was a lot of fun. And then the second one was coming out. And I was like, I mean, I'll get to it eventually. And then the third one came out and I'm like, well, I still have to see the second one.
The last two are pretty awful. Like, honestly.
Are they?
Yeah.
I didn't even make it to the end. Like, I watched the first one all hyped up for it. And then I enjoyed it. And then I immediately like dropped off the bandwagon and was just kind of like, well, I don't really have a drive, but I don't know why I didn't have a drive because I did like it. I just didn't feel motivated either.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, same, but I was like much younger when that was coming out, so when they did get released, I enjoyed them because I'm just a stupid kid. But now looking at them, I'm like, man, this has so many flaws and it's so typical in a lot of ways,
yeah,
that like I just don't have any real enjoyment out of these. Which I mean, I guess that's like kind of what you would expect from like a teen dystopian thing, that like a just kind of a genre that pops up so suddenly and then just as quickly disappears after a couple years. But like Hunger Games was like the big one, and that, like you were saying, fell off like real quick. And I think for a lot of people, they had the same exact feeling that you did of just like, you know, I've seen my fill. I'm done. You know?
Yeah. You watch that first movie and you're satisfied. There's just like an immediate burnout.
Yeah. And when you like think back on it, there's also still like a lot of stupid stuff that happens in it. But like, again, it's one of those movies where you should be able to look past it and just enjoy it for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm.
For a movie that doesn't get as much credit, this one might be a little bit more obscure. To the Wonder by Terrence Malick.
I remember you talking about Terrence Malick.
Yes, he was my favorite director. Now I'd say he's probably my second favorite, but I don't really have like a comprehensive list. But I had like a deep interest in him and his work. And To the Wonder is kind of a like a loose biopic in a way.
Okay.
And I think like it got a lot of really bad reviews, except for interestingly enough, Roger Ebert, which it was the last movie he ever reviewed, and he gave it like a great review, and then he just died. So that was interesting.
Just for that story alone, I think it's kind of worth its little moment to shine.
But I find it very touching and personal. I think a lot of people wouldn't enjoy it for like it's kind of overly sentimental and somewhat sappy, poetic dialogue and the kind of exaggerated shots and the way that the actors kind of flow around all the time. But for me, it's something that I do enjoy just for like the filmmaking itself, but also for this specific movie, whereas a couple of his other movies like Knight of Cups or like Song of Song, I don't enjoy them story-wise. I think they're kind of like lacking in that department. But because of the added knowledge of Terrence Malick's background and how this is just like him getting that out there, really adds like a new like dimension to it for me and makes it feel way more personal. It's all in French and or Spanish. There's occasional moments of English, but mainly like I'd say 90% French, 7 to 8% Spanish, and then 2% English maybe. So you know, that's probably going to be a barrier for a lot of people as it is, but it's got a fantastic cast with Olga Kurylenko. She's a great actress. Rachel McAdams shows up for a while, and she's her image, she doesn't speak very much at all, but her image itself, she has such an interesting look that really captures the camera, and like that, like she that's used to like a great extent. Javier Bardem, who's one of my favorite actors, is in it. They use a lot of real people. They have Ben Affleck in it, but I'm not a big fan of Ben Affleck. But he has legit no lines in this movie, except for like tiny little quiet moments you hear in the background. So they kind of use like him the only way you can use Ben Affleck and still make a good movie. So, and it's all shot by Chivo, who's Emmanuel Lubezki, who is in my opinion probably the greatest living cinematographer, like better than Deakins to me. So yeah, that's like it's and it's got a beautiful classical score, somewhat orchestral at times. Amazing locations. It uses Oklahoma as a setting for a large portion of the film, and it's still able to make it look fantastic and gorgeous, just the suburbs somehow. It also they shoot in Paris and other parts of France that looks absolutely breathtaking. Beautiful. Not really much of a story you can pick out, but still all the amazing filmmaking that goes into it and like Malick's background and philosophy kind of add so much to it that like I think it deserves a lot of praise and love that it generally does not get by anyone other than dead film critics. What do you think?
So as far as underrated, I think so. I my first immediate thought was I wanted to say Scott Pilgrim versus the World, because I feel like that was like a cult classic and the people that saw it really liked it, but it didn't get a lot of fanfare. It didn't perform well at the box office. It's just not like a well-known film.
I think the cult has grown quite a bit for that one, though.
So in that one, I was kind of like, that's kind of, you know, again, it's kind of a cop out just because I like that movie so much. And I was thinking, because the same thing, because then I started thinking like Baby Driver, and that performed even better. That one's even less of an argument.
Yeah, Baby Driver did
But
great.
yeah, the one I ended up on that I kind of started thinking like this is probably like a fair argument is really either one of the Safdie brothers movies.
Ah, that's
Either
really good. That's really
like
good.
especially Good Time, but
Oh,
even
Good
like
Time's amazing.
I feel like Uncut Gems tried to market the fact that it was a Adam Sandler movie, but it came out at like the wrong time to perform. I don't know if it would have done better regardless, because when people go to an Adam Sandler movie, they have a certain expectation, I feel like. And so looking at the trailers and stuff, I don't know if it would have performed any better or not if it hadn't been during a pandemic. But I think either Good Time or Uncut Gems would be a good vote for like this is a movie that I feel like just both of those kind of flew under the radar, and both of them deserve more, a lot more recognition than they got.
I'm glad that they get like the appropriate critic, like seeing it and observing it and seeing like the real amazing pieces of art that they are.
Yeah.
But like you're saying with like fan wise, like being able to reach those audiences, like that they haven't really gotten an opportunity for that yet. Mm-hmm. And that, like you said, is like really kind of taking a lot away from, like, taking a bit of the wind out of its sails for the movies. I definitely prefer Good Time over Uncut Gems, but I do love Uncut Gems still.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to agree. Those are like amazing films that like haven't gotten the recognition that they really do deserve from general audiences. I'd say that they are somewhat inaccessible in certain spheres. Like if you're like in a Midwest town, I don't think you'd really enjoy like a Midwest really conservative town. I don't think you'd really enjoy Good Time or Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
Cause it's very vulgar, very intense, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Uncut Gems. That movie is relentless. That will just, oh my God.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
And I feel like you could say that about a lot of different people for a lot of reasons. Cause it's the same way I feel like, maybe not to the extent that Star Wars is just so overhyped and such a part of our
Zeitgeist.
Circles. Yeah. But to an extent, I feel like people like Tarantino are kind of overrated in certain respects, because
they've definitely transcended that like kind of auteur gap that usually comes with like the money making, but still like the cinematic vision and all that.
Yeah. Cause like, I mean, don't get me wrong, he's made some really great movies, but I feel like those should be kind of more cliche movies. And
what do you mean? So,
like, as in, I have an audience in my head that I picture Tarantino appealing to, and I feel like he almost like undeservedly gets more recognition than he should get. You know, like, I feel like he's gotten this broader appeal that I don't quite understand.
Know if I agree with that.
No?
No, I wouldn't say so, but I want to hear like your point for it. So, go ahead.
I mean, he's got some that work really well for wide audiences. I think, you know, movies like like his Grindhouse submission, Death
That's
Proof,
definitely an outlier.
And even movies like Kill Bill, both of the Kill Bill movies, Django Unchained, movies like that, are a little bit more mainstream and accessible. But I feel like some of his more, I don't know if like slice of life is the right term, but some of those more like contained films that just show like a certain time period and a certain era, movies like Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction are well-made movies, but whenever I see them, I don't think of them as like broad appeal movies. I think of them as appealing to like a certain target audience.
I can see you with those two, definitely. Yeah,
but they've blown up to this point of like pop culture recognition anyway.
Yeah,
but I don't feel like it makes a lot of sense to me, and I don't know if the people that recognize them even fully know them. I almost feel like a lot of the fan base they have are based on like a couple of iconic scenes and like the movie poster or something like that.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
Everybody can recognize like the Pulp Fiction poster with Uma Thurman laying there with the cigarette and stuff. And then like the dancing scene with John Travolta and what's the other one? There's like the scene at the beginning of Pulp Fiction where Samuel L. Jackson is delivering his monologue, stuff like that. They're these iconic parts of Pulp Fiction that I think everybody knows, but I almost wonder if it's reached like a point where people think they know Pulp Fiction based on a couple of iconic scenes that have transcended, but they don't really know Pulp Fiction, you know?
Yeah, people that haven't actually like fully delved into the film.
Yeah.
Itself.
Yeah.
I'd agree with you in that they make no sense being as popular and I guess pulpy as they are. Mm-hmm. But I do think that they have an appeal that general audience goers would, you know, have fun with. Like, what's your opinion on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood when it comes to like that kind of view?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood would have been a more niche film. He made the right choice by hiring big name actors. I think if it wasn't DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, it would start to fall into that same trap of like Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown. But because Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt are Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt, it kind of lends itself more to that mainstream appeal.
So you think like that it's the story itself and how it's portrayed, if it wasn't for those two, it would be incredibly niche like the other ones?
Maybe not quite as niche, but yes, to an extent.
Yeah, I don't know if I fully agree with that. I definitely see what you mean with like how specific the time is and the setting is and like everything that you see, like the production design and all that, for mm-hmm. sure. I definitely agree with you there. But I think when it comes to storyline and like plots and all that, how like, you know, Leo is constantly trying to like, he's finds himself in this rut that like, you know, everyone would generally find themselves in, and he's having to like lean on other people and rely on them to try and like, you know, keep him out of this until he finally gets his feet back on the ground. And in the end, I think the payoff is amazing when mm-hmm. like not only the giant violent fight at the end, which is incredible, I love that, but yeah. also when Margot Robbie sees him and is like, oh, you're Rick Dalton, and like and recognizes him and gives him that kind of recognition, that satisfaction that he really wants for people to recognize him and remember him as an actor, mm-hmm. and all that, I think that that kind of hits chords with audiences a lot, mm-hmm. And that it can, you know, it is one of those movies that can kind of, you know, transcend that niche audience and become a worldwide kind of phenomenon.
Okay. Yeah. I can but see
with
that.
Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, I think you're definitely right with those two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I started thinking about it with that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I think, but even to a lesser degree, like, I don't want you to get the wrong idea. I don't want you to think I'm saying the exact same thing. But I think to a lesser extent, you could even say that about some of Scorsese's filmography. I think it's kind of the same way, where like some of his movies, even like his bigger ones, you know, it's like as prolific as like The Godfather and The Godfather Part Two are, there's a certain audience that I expect to know The Godfather, and then certain people where I just assume, oh, they've never actually seen The Godfather, you know? But like, with like The Wolf of Wall Street, I feel like having Leonardo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill and just having the right people in it got like a lot of people to go see The Wolf of Wall Street. But I don't know if it would have performed as well without them in it.
Hold on a second, Tyler. Were you referring to The Godfather and The Godfather Part Two as Scorsese movies?
I was. Am I wrong?
Those are Francis Ford Coppola movies.
They are. I'm just dumb.
And like, that's as soon as you said it too.
Like, as damn. Soon as you said the name too, I was like, oh yeah. And I don't even know where I made that connection. I don't know why I even.
Goodfellas is like, he's made all those movies that are like, he's made a few gangster movies like Goodfellas.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just like by association. I don't know. I don't know where that even came from, but you're right.
I think that he's kind of had a weird advantage in that way, where him and Robert De Niro's careers took off at the exact same time because of each other.
Yeah.
So because of that, they were kind of able to piggyback off each other and gain that like worldwide recognition and success, as like they're both getting Oscar nominations and De Niro getting all the wins and everything. And everyone's like, oh, I hear about this Robert De Niro guy. He's in these movies. Who made those movies? Martin Scorsese and all that. Yeah. And because that relationship has carried on for so many decades, that those two have been able to, like, you know, kind of keep each other afloat for the most part. I'm not saying that those are like the only reason that they each other are the only reason why they've been able to keep afloat, but they're definitely helping. Mm-hmm. And then that's why he can make stuff with Leo and all that. And I'm sure that if he didn't have Robert De Niro, he would still find like major success. But because he did, he's seen as like the greatest living director by a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And for good reason. I don't know if I fully agree with it, but I'm definitely like really leaning towards it.
Well, and I feel like that happens a lot. You kind of have those directors that like find their muse almost and like really stick with it for better or for worse.
His was just some Italian man from New York.
Yeah. And, you know, for them, it worked out really well. And it's the same, like, I'm not trying to say that, you know, they're all as good as Scorsese and De Niro. But, I mean, like, you think, like, Tim Burton and Johnny Depp kind of had that same relationship for, what, like, 20 or 30 years. It was, like,
it was just assumed. Started to fall off immediately after Ed Wood, but yeah.
Yeah. But it was that same kind of relationship. Like, it was just kind of like, oh, there's a new Tim Burton movie. Johnny Depp's probably going to pop up somewhere. And Helena Bonham Carter is probably going to pop up somewhere. And I mean, that's his wife. I can't really say anything there, but.
That's true. They are, like, a perfect match, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's like one of those cinema odd couples that's like not even really that odd because they complement each other perfectly.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, like I fully agree. And that should be like another good discussion is like cinematic dynamic duos.
Yeah.
At a time. I think that'd be really fun.
Well, I mean, you could break that down into even like sub, you know, you could have like directors with their actors, or you know, like actor pairs that always work together, stuff like that.
Add director, cinematographer stuff.
Yeah. And then or like directors and composers.
Ooh, that's another good one. I love that. Clint Mansell and Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah. There's another and even while we've been talking, I thought of like four more like Brad Pitt movies that I want to bring up, but I'm like, I feel like that bears its own discussion now.
We have to save that for another. I am a massive Brad Pitt fan. I am sweaty over Brad Pitt. Not only because I think he's an extremely attractive man. I think everyone knows that, but also because he is a very underrated actor. As like if he didn't have this like this sculpture image, and he was just like a regular dude, he would be one of those like Ed Harris's kind of like Sam Elliott kind of like well known character actors that always gives a great performance and will get nominated every once in a while, but like you know, everyone knows them.
To an extent, he let himself get pigeonholed that way.
Yeah, especially in the 90s.
Yeah, because of the movies he started accepting just based on his looks.
He kind of had to, though.
But I think he's been able to come out of that and really come into his own over the years as well.
He's always shown a propensity to, like, go, like, when he can pick his roles, to go for one of those weird roles. Yeah. Like in 12 Monkeys. Or, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Oh.
So are we doing this now? You want to
No. We should save this for another episode because I could talk about Brad Pitt and his roles for so long.
Yeah.
So this is definitely gonna be a whole other episode.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think that's another good point, where we could either say let's keep going or let's not keep going.
I think we can end it there. Yeah.
All right. So thank you guys for joining us today and tuning in. It was good to have Garrett here. Hopefully this will become a pretty normal thing. I feel like it will, even if we don't save it for the podcast. I feel like this is going to be one of those things that we just end up doing for fun. Just because it's a kind of cathartic for both of us to have someone to like talk to about like really deep dive into this stuff with.
Yeah, exactly.
Because so many people around us get really bored and tune us out.
Oh my God. God bless my girlfriend and your wife for like listening to us talk about just these things all the time
and loving us despite how much we talk about this stuff. But yeah, so thank you guys for tuning in today, and we hope to either see you or hear you or however you want to join us for the next one.
Taste you.
Bye. Yes. You can taste us, smell us. We're adding in all sorts of new features to the podcast. We're going to
do 4D in the future. Yeah.
We're bringing back the 3D fad, but with even more.
It's going to be disgusting. You're going to get like sprays of water on you and stuff. It'll be gross. We spit a lot.
Water.
What a great place to end it on.
Yeah. All right. So until the next episode, have a great week. Bye.
Bye.